Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
I am Velocity Child, and every Friday at the stroke of midnight, ride the broomstick with fallen woman, stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.
One feels a terrible despair, and yet is helpless to act. And the relatives stood in an anxious little huddle, and they whispered, "Send in the child! The child! The child! Send in the child!" They went in to my uncle, and he tearfully took my hands, and his words were ever so many, and I tried, but I could not quite grasp the meaning of his words with my mind. But the tone of his broken words, and all the hopes and fears behind and underneath them, I felt these. I not only understood them, but I felt like I could cry for him, and for all the people of the world. I felt like I could cry until the very end of time. So everyone in the community prayed, literally prayed, in the pews of the churches, for the road commission to come to their senses, for the bureaucrats to change their plans for the good of all, for the carving of the land to be stopped, for God to send this highway away, far away, forever. But it was not meant to be. Every day the earth movers came. And every day they bleated and whined and ground, cutting down and through the prime forest and farmland. One morning we heard Uncle outside and the sounds of hoes and rakes clashing and clattering and stacks of iron tools falling over. "I am doing something," Uncle cried. "I am doing something." He seized two enormous shovels. Our shovels and hoes were sharpened on great whetstone wheels. All tool edges were sharp as razors. This was a holdover from the old country, where one might have to use one's tools not only to dig, but also to defend oneself. And no one in the family had lived long enough away from war to have found reason to outgrow this practice. So everyone cried, "No, Tsofar! No! Put the shovels down! What are you doing? Do not do something rash! Tsofar! Tsofar!" But Uncle did not answer. He marched toward the fields with a shovel on either shoulder. "One to rest and one to work," he said. All morning he dug in a small parcel of what was left of a larger field after the toll road bed had cut through. In their passion to make the road, some workers had plowed up far more field land than needed, and the broken trunks of trees and the destroyed corn rows were all that they had left behind. They turned a living field into debris, and then they walked away. The new toll road was now complete, and its pavement lay less than 300 yards to the west, and so Uncle dug deeply along the perimeter of the field, following the general camber of the new highway and leaving behind a long, snaking mound of dirt. He dug and he shoveled and he shoveled and dug, and various neighbor men interrupted their own work to walk down the road to advise. And they returned with shovels and pickaxes to help. By afternoon, for as far as one could see, there was a trench that ran along the edge of about one half of 1 hectare. It was perhaps 2 cubits wide across the narrow side of the field that would remain in village hands. And night fell, and Uncle trudged home, and he ate a big meal of soup from a pottery bowl with a mujur bird painted on the side, and he chewed down a chunk of black homemade rye bread, and he downed a stinging cold beer from an amber glass bottle, and then he left the house again, carrying an old dented red bucket brimming with fuel. He walked, tilted way over to one side with his burden. There in the field, in the completely windless night, He carefully poured the fuel all along the field on two sides and once down the middle. And from the edge of the field, he struck wooden stick matches and threw them in low at several places. And the entire field erupted in a blaze so great that it drew people from as far away as the black smoke cloud in the night sky could be seen. The wide dirt roads on three sides and the trench on one side kept the blaze contained. Far into the night, men and women with sleepy children in their arms stood in long orange lines, nodding their heads approvingly and watching the field burn and burn. The next day the field was still smoldering but fire dead, and with his razor-sharp hoe, Uncle was skinning back the blackened roots and stubble here and there, thereby exposing the earth even more. "So you see," he said, "this burning and blackening of the soil here? Soon much will come of it, so much that you will not believe it." I asked him, "What will we seed here?" "Ha! I will seed nothing here," he said. I did not understand. We had burnt land before, for the ash made tired ground more fertile again. "Well, why will you leave the land bare and unseeded, Uncle?" "As an invitation, my girl." Uncle explained that the pines and the oaks would not spread into the fields to grow and make a new woods unless we left the ground unseeded. My uncle envisioned that this barren land was to become a tiny new forest, one of great beauty and repose. As he said, to be poor and be without trees is to be the most starved human being in the world. To be poor and to have trees is to be completely rich in ways that money can never buy. The trees, he said, would not come if the land were planted. The seeds of new life will find no hospitality or reason to rest here unless we leave it barren, unless we leave it bare, so that a forest of seeds will find it hospitable. Long ago, Uncle's father had a good friend who gave him these words, and these my uncle taught to me. Hak Masat, or Him, they mean hospitality, especially to strangers. Uncle explained that this was the principle by which they strove to live before the war, the principle by which they attempted to live during the war. And now again after the war, it was the principle that we were to use in order to try to live again. Uncle said that it was a blessing to welcome the stranger, to give comfort to the wanderer, and especially to the weary traveler, just as the hospitable laugh waits for a joke it can laugh at. Just as the dying are hospitable in awaiting with grace the arrival of the one, so too the land has the hospitality of a true host. For the earth is so patient, you see. It takes the seed, the weed, the tree, the flower. It takes the rain, the grain, the fire. It allows and invites entry. It is the perfect host. I understood what Uncle said. The seeds of the earth, the creatures of the earth, the stars overhead, and we ourselves, we were all guests of this field. So we left the land bare, so that the seeds would know to find their way to it. They would be carried there in the mouths of small animals who might know this field was waiting. They would drop the seeds here. The raccoon would eat and deposit what was left in the field. The deer scratching against a post would release the seeds riding in its pelt, and the mourning doves flying over might drop seeds from their beaks, and the weather in the sky and the air would join together to bring in seeds on the wind. "You will see," said my uncle, "all because of the tremendous Hak Masat Orchim of this land. A great thing will begin to happen here. Do you know how to make trees grow as wild and beautiful as any you have ever seen? You leave the land hospitable. You leave it bare. How do you do that? It is not a great surprise. As for a guest, first you put out water. Oh, God has already done this for us. Here in the fields, God calls this rain. What a great host is God. Well, well, next you put out sun and some shade. Oh, in clouds and sun. Huh, God is taking care of this also. Huh, what a great host is God. Lastly, you leave the ground fallow. What does that mean? It means you leave it turned but unsown. It means you send it through fire in order to prepare it for its new life. This is the part God does not do alone. God likes a partnership. It is up to us to help what God has begun. No one wants this kind of burning, this kind of fire. We want the field to remain as it once was, in its pristine beauty, just as we want life to remain as it once was. But believe me, fire comes. Though we are afraid, it comes anyway. Sometimes by accident, sometimes on purpose, and sometimes for reasons no one can understand, reasons that are God's business alone. But the fire can also turn everything to a new direction, a new and different life, one that has its own strength and ways to shape the world. I could already see that what Uncle said was in some ways true. I could see with my own eyes that just overnight the field was already alive again after being burned, alive with the tiniest life, walking stick creatures that stood out like little bright green straws against the black ash at the edge of the field, and ant men in black trousers and red waistcoats were strolling about here and there. "There's a story I'll tell you," said Uncle, "a story, an important one, about the time of peace and the time of ashes, about how the young and the old learn about that which can never die." Uncle pulled a big, untidy cigar from the cotton bag he wore around his waist when he was in the fields. Among other items in this bag were his big knife, a spare neckerchief, a few iron nails for the fruit trees, some stick matches, and a little long-haired goatskin flask of what he called liquid remedy. Uncle had told me before, "This is liquid remedy, for if I cut myself, I can pour it on the cut. If I am lucky enough not to cut myself, then I drink this remedy every day in order to stay healthy." He bit off the end of his cigar and trimmed it with his knife, and he puffed and puffed and puffed to light it. He stuck his big knife in the ground to one side, and we sat there at the edge of this small blackened field surrounded by taller fields, filled with ripening corn, and Uncle's long pleated pantaloons flowed around his boots. His big hat shaded his face. I sat with my legs straight out, the toes of my scuffed brown shoes turned inward, the shoes' old straps curled at the ends, just after they passed through the rusty buckles. "You see," said Uncle, "once upon a time, a long, long time ago, during the time that the blessed animals could still speak and human beings could still understand the language of animals, there was a young fir tree who, though small in stature, was vast in spirit. And he lived deep in a forest surrounded by trees far greater, far more majestic, and far more ancient than any heretofore known. Each winter, fathers and mothers and their children traveled deep into the forest in old wooden sleighs, and with much happiness and festivity they cut several of the medium-sized trees and carried them off. The venerable horses drawing the sleighs snuffled, and the bells on their harnesses went ring-tingling, and the laughter of the children and the grown-ups rang out all through the woods. Oh, yes, the little fir tree had heard it whispered about among the oldest trees, those who were too tall and too great to be taken by the axe and hauled away. Oh, yes, he had heard that the trees that were cut down were taken to a wondrous place, to something called a home. and there they were treated with greatest respect, smoothed by many hands and placed in a soothing water. And then, it was said, an entire family of smiling people gathered around and dressed the tree with small, beautiful objects and little globes made of ribbon with nut meats inside and sugar cookies and other goodies, and glorious little candles were lit and placed in the crooks and arms of the tree, so finally there, festooned with candles and strings of fruit and sometimes even glass ornaments and tiny colored mirrors, the tree became the most honored guest of the home. It was indeed one of the most magnificent glories that any tree could ever be granted. Among the oldest trees who knew about these matters, it was said also that this was, for the humans concerned, a time of great joy. For beautiful little children came singing, and fires burned in every hearth, and even the stars of the sky seemed to shine all the more. As the old ones described it, hither and yon young women and men could be found scurrying and carrying into the parlor whatever food they had to share with all, and the old women were in their best white aprons, and the old men wore their best black suits, and all the women wore their best black dresses, and all the boys were in trousers that always itched, and the girls were in skirts just right for practicing curtsies. Oh! It all sounded completely wonderful, and this is what the young tree dreamed about. Year after year, the fir tree waited for the summer to pass, for autumn to arrive, and finally for the lovely winter to come. And when he felt the bite of the chill winds, he rejoiced. He was most happy then in his great green coat that grew fuller with each passing year. And every year, too, in the winter, the sleighs came and cut the trees again, while the children shouted and made snow angels in the great drifts. And though the little fir tree was shy, he could not help himself and cried out more boldly each year, "Come, choose me, choose me. I love children. I love this fabled celebration that you do. Choose me, please, choose me." But year after year, no one chose him. Soon many trees had been taken from the forest around him, and now his nearest relative stood quite far off, and the little fir tree stood rather alone, but also in full sunshine. And so he grew and grew and grew much taller than ever before. And in the following winter, again came horses pulling a sleigh of laughing children, mother and father, and the horses pranced right past the fir tree, for the father was assessing the thick grove of trees far ahead. "Wait," cried one of the children, "that one back there, that one standing all by itself." And the fir tree began to tremble with hope. "Oh, yes, come closer. Choose me. Please, choose me." The fir tree struggled to stand straighter and taller, and the family must have heard him, for the sleigh stopped, and the horses trotted around about and made their way back, and soon the family was pushing their way through the deep snow to inspect the tree. "Oh, see how bouncy are its branches," cried one child, who had the most perfect ruddy cheeks. "Oh, see how green and fresh this tree is," said the mother. "Oh, yes," said the father, "this one looks not too tall and not too short, but rather just right for us." And the father brought his axe from the sleigh. At its first strike, the fir tree felt the greatest pain he had ever known in his entire life. "Oh," cried the tree, "I fall." And right there and then he swooned. And the axe continued to strike until the tree was severed from its root, falling over in a great shower of snow. Much later, the fir tree came too, on the sled swaying behind the sleigh, and the bells on the harnesses of the horses tinkled, and the fir tree could hear people talking and laughing, and the most terrible of the pain seemed to be passing now, and besides, he remembered vaguely they were going somewhere, somewhere important. Somewhere beautiful and wondrous, somewhere he had wished and wished to see all the days and years of his life past. And at this point in the story, Uncle stopped to trim his shaggy cigar. "You know, my girl, do you not, what we say at times like this, in a story?" I did know, for we had played this game many times before. It was the way that my family taught children to tell the stories of the elders. "Oh, yes," I piped up. "What we say at a time like this in a story is, at the first turn in the story, at a moment like this, we say, like gypsies, when the caravan begins to sway forward, even though we are leaving one place that is known for another place unknown, no one is ever sad." "Very good," smiled my uncle, and he ruffled my hair. "For that fine reply, you shall be rewarded with the next part of the story." And so, at last, as darkness fell, the sleigh, with the family in it and the tree on the sled behind, came to a halt before a snow-covered cottage, and an old man and old woman came out into the snow and gathered around the sled, exclaiming, "What a fine, fine tree! So tall and so wide, just the right size, just perfect!" "Oh," thought the tree, "how good it is to be welcomed! I wonder, is this the place where some of my kin have come to over all these years? Oh, I hope I shall see them again soon." The old people lifted him down from the sled with gentle hands, and they admired him and patted him, turning him this way and that, and they placed the cut trunk of the tree into a bucket of cool water that soothed much of his soreness. And as they turned out the lanterns, the fir tree, who loved the deep and dark of the forest, began also to love the darkness of this home. Even though he was used to seeing the entire night sky of stars and now could see only a bit of night sky through a small pane of window, there was one star that twinkled more than the others, and seeing this, the fir tree felt there was much promise yet to come. And with these thoughts, he, like the rest of the household, soon fell happily and fast asleep. And early the next morning there was much noise and commotion, with everyone greeting and complaining and gossiping, and someone was knocking the dust out of the wood chip bucket and filling it clink, clank, clunk, and the dogs were racing in, yip, yip, yipping, following by the children and the mother and the father, and then the old ones and the other children and friends as well, all carrying many boxes. And the tree waited, veritably holding its breath with excitement, and the people pulled the covers off the boxes, and inside were ornaments of all shapes and sizes, and around the tree was strung and draped with these, and oh, glory be, dozens of candles were lit one after the other, and these placed in circles and spirals higher and higher in his boughs. And all of this that the old ones back in the forest had described, and so much more, was coming true. And he made a great effort to stretch out his limbs further, and he tried to look as handsome as possible. And the children cried out and ran in circles around him, while others played music and sang. And oh, what joy, especially when one beautiful child, held up by his grandfather, placed a paper star upon the crown branch at the very top of the tree. That night, after the children were asleep and the fir tree was drowsing, and as that great star shone through the windows, the old ones crept into the room with gifts wrapped in beautiful soft brown paper and in cloth scraps they had pieced together with bright embroidery floss, and they placed these on the mantel. All of these were made with hands filled with a kind of love that desires to surprise and delight little children. In the morning, the tree awakened with a start as the children came racing and shrieking, exclaiming, "Oh, look at the beautiful tree and the gifts underneath!" And they pulled open the wrappings and held up lovely rag dolls with rich brown yarn curls and hand-crocheted dresses, and then they unwrapped wagons made from scrap wood with wheels that really turned. They happily tore the nut meats from the fir tree, and the tree rustled its branches in happiness to be so much a part of all that he had dreamed and more. And by late in the day, the children were napping on the rug, and the grown-ups snoozed as well, and even the dogs and cats were asleep and dreaming, and the tree reflected on its exquisite fate and all the events that had come to pass, and he was very, very happy. The following day and the next, the tree stood proudly in the same room, even though a bit bedraggled from having all its ribbons torn from it and its star tipped over one of its eyes. Nevertheless, all was glorious, for even as the fir tree saw most of the children and grown-ups climb into their sleighs and depart, he thought, "Oh, they'll be back. They'll be back tonight. And then they will put my sore trunk in fresh and cool water once again, and they will decorate me once more, and the celebration will begin all over again." The father tramped in then and stripped the ornaments from the fir tree, laying these in boxes in layers of cotton batting. And then he pulled the tree from its water and shook it so hard that whatever else might have been hidden in its boughs fell to the floor. And he left the strands of dried cranberries on the tree and dragged it from the room. The fir tree, though startled at this brusque treatment, was yet hopeful. "Oh, I wonder what room we are going to next." He imagined the entire joyous process of decorating and gifts and children dancing and everyone singing, and he sighed to think of it all. But the father hauled the fir tree roughly up the wooden staircase that led upward and upward and upward. And the steps became more and more narrow the higher they climbed, and at last, at the topmost landing, the father opened a small door and without ceremony threw the tree inside. And the tree cried out in alarm, in what seemed to him like a great shout, "What darkness is this?" But in fact no one seemed to hear, for the father shut the door and retreated down the stairs. At this place in the story, my uncle sighed, and the stub of his cigar held in those startling dark teeth of his had gone out again. "Ah," he said, as he relit his cigar, "here we are at the place in the story of this little life, where the only change that is certain is that there will be change. Do you understand what I say?" I thought I understood, but I was not completely sure. I thought for a good long while, ought I reply, "If the violin player has lost his violin, he can still sing?" No. I could see from Uncle's solemn face that this was not the right proverb, not the right answer. Was it, "In the army, there's no Peter Bacci?" In meaning, "In the army, there is no Uncle Peter?" This means that under extreme duress there is no nice overseer to bind up one's wounds? No, I could see that was not the right answer either. Uncle's face was completely attentive to me. He was waiting like a dog waits, with the slightest trembling just under the skin. Uncle was waiting for me to say just one right word, and if or when I did, he would be ready to instantly nod or wink or smile or shout or slap his knee. Then I remembered. I tried it out, lowering my voice. "Does it mean, dear uncle, when you say the only change that is certain is that there will be change, does it mean that though we think we are following the right map," and here uncle began to smile, "that God suddenly decides to lift up the road, placing it and us elsewhere?" Uncle began to nod happily. "Oh, school is not wasted on you, my child," Uncle roared. "Yes, yes. Though we think we are following the rightful map, God suddenly decides to lift up the road, placing it and us elsewhere. That is it, exactly." And he placed his big hands on each side of my face. "Now you have earned the rest of the story. So you see, in this small, cold attic room, there was no light, save for one small frosty window in the eaves of the house through which shone that great star. Oh, woe is me," thought the tree, feeling all of its limbs to see if anything were broken. "What have I done that I should be abandoned in such a cold and lonely place?" But no one heard. And there the fir tree remained for many days and many nights. One particular night, however, out of the corner of its eye, the tree saw four glowing red dots, and these were the eyes of two tiny mice who occupied the attic walls. "Oh," he said to them softly, Oh, my ladies, do you know when they will come to take me from this attic and carry me to the special room again? The mouse in coveralls and muffler began to chatter and laugh. Come to get you and take you to the special room again? But the other mouse in her little gown and white apron elbowed her friend and spoke to the tree in a kindly way. Oh, dear tree, why, you have just lived a good life, have you not? Yes, nodded the tree sadly. I know that you felt you were born to this life, so much so you did not wish for it to change, but, and here she patted the tree, all things, dear tree, even good things, come to an end. This time must end? The fir tree cried. Yes, said the little mouse, reaching up and patting the tree again. Yes, this time has come to an end. But now a different time begins, a new life, a different kind of life always follows the old. You'll see. And the two little mice sat with the tree throughout the night, and they told stories and sang all the songs they knew. And the fir tree asked if the mice would like to climb into its boughs to stay warmer, and they said thank you very much, they would. And they did so. And together, they all slept through the dark night with the great star outside the window coming closer and closer, almost as though it knew their truth, and taking pity, shone its light ever more deeply upon them. In the morning, the fir tree and the mice were rudely awakened by the sound of heavy footfalls on the stairs, and the mouse couple jumped from the limbs of the fir tree. Farewell, dear friend! Remember us as we shall remember you and your kindness. And the mice ran for the crevice in the wall. And I you, called the tree, and I shall remember you also. The attic door banged open, and the father, wearing a woolen cap and greatcoat, seized the fir tree and dragged it down the many stairs through the door and into the yard. And there he laid the fir tree across an old stump and hoisted high a great axe which fell upon the tree with the most terrible weight, causing the most awful sounds of tearing wood. And at the first chop, the tree thought it would die from the pain, and by the second it had fainted dead away. A long while later, the fir tree awakened in the corner of the special room again, and while not quite itself, seemed to be missing only its greenery, and its arms were arranged quite differently and rather in pieces. But he saw there, in the chairs before the fireplace, the old couple who had first cared for him when he came to their home from the forest. They were the ones who long ago had soothed his wound with cold water. There they were, drawn close together before the fire. In spite of his condition, the fir tree smiled at the love he saw between them. The old man rose and put one of the arms of the fir tree into the fire, and though at first the fir tree resisted and cried out, he soon understood, as the flame burned more and more deeply into the heart of himself, that this was his joyous work in the world also, to create a warmth for such as these. Oh, to be warmed from the inside by love, and from the outside by the love of one such as he. The fir tree burnt ever harder and stronger then. Oh, I never knew I could burn with such brightness, that I could fill a room with such warmth. I love these old ones with all my heart. And the fir tree and all the knots in its wood and in its heart burst with joy in the flame. And here, as you might know, my uncle stopped once more to say that in old Europe, here was where the story ended, but that he knew a deeper story, a larger story. a healing story. And so he continued. Night after night, the fir tree surrendered himself to this rendering. He was so completely glad to be useful and to be alive in this way that he burned and burned until there was no more left of him, except for the ashes that lay in the bottom of the grate. And as he was being brushed out of the grate by the old people, he thought he had never imagined more glory than his life had been till now, and that he could never again wish for more than had been his life up to this very moment. The elderly couple was very careful, and with their wise old hands they gently swept out every bit of ash from the fire pit, and they placed the ashes in a soft and well-used bag, and this they stored away until the springtime arrived. At the first warming of the earth, the old man and old woman brought out the bag of ashes and entered their gardens and fields and carefully spread the ashes of the fir tree throughout and over all of their fruiting vines, over all of their lands as well. And they mixed the fir tree's ashes in with the soil. And over time, as the springtime rains and sun came and stayed, the ashes of the fir tree felt a quickening beneath himself. Here and there, all below and through and around the ashes, came tiny, bright green shoots breaking through the ground, and the fir tree smiled 1,000 smiles and sighed 1,000 sighs in its happiness for being useful once more. Oh, I never knew one could fall to such ashes and yet bring forth such new life again. What great luck has come into my life. I grew up in the solitude of the forest. Later, what fine days and nights of tinkling glasses and candlelight and singing I did come to know. In my time of loneliness and need in the darkest night, I was befriended by strangers, those who wanted to be family and more. And even as I was being rendered by the fire, I found I could give forth immense light and warmth from the heart of me. What luck, what fortune I have had. Of all that rises and falls and rises again, it is love of new life, and love of that alone that lasts and lasts. I am everywhere now. See how far my reach. And that night, as the great star traversed the universe's night sky, the fir tree lay in the blessed earth, hovering close to all the roots and seeds to warm them, his own ashes nourishing forever all things that grow, and these in turn nourishing others, who in turn would nourish others yet, and for all generations to come. In that beauteous earth, from whence he came, and now to which he was returned, he slept well and dreamed deeply, surrounded there, as he had been once before in the deep forest, by that which is far greater, far more majestic, and far more ancient than any heretofore known. And my uncle said to me, "Do you see, my child? There is no worthless thing. Everything can be used for something. In God's garden there is a usefulness for everyone and everything." In our family, we say, "Go out into the fields to weep, for there your tears will do both you and the land great good." And so Uncle and I sat in the fields for a good long while, alternately talking softly and trading some stories and weeping just a little at the sad parts and happy parts of our lives and of the tales. And finally Uncle said, "I pronounce that we have properly christened this ground completely." And he dried his eyes with the back of his big hands, and he put his arm around me and brushed my tears away with his long neckerchief. Then it was late and time for us to go home. And Uncle pulled me to my feet and we hoisted the hose onto our shoulders and he helped me to find just the right balance for the hose weight. "Let us see," he said as we walked, "what will come of our field. Perhaps by morning it will be an entire forest again." And he laughed, and he bent down to straighten my hoe, and he gave me a great big wink. And we walked home through the dusk, the burnt ground sleeping for now in the twilight behind us. And as we slept that night, seeds from all corners of our world began to travel toward the open field with all God's speed. And so it came to be that over time, this field opened by burning, this field, fallow and waiting, drew just the right strangers, just the right seeds to itself in all its hospitality. In all due time, tiny trees began to appear. The oaks came, the white pines came, the silver and red maples came, and even green and red willows found their way to the farthest bend of the hospitable field where there was a small groundwater waiting for them. To Uncle, these trees were like young people, alive and courting and dancing again. He was ever so joyous, and so was I. Over a long period of time, for hardwood trees grow very slowly, there grew up a small forest and a thick ground cover with plenty of thatch for snow forts and secret places for sheltering us at our games and small dappled clearings that made praying and resting places for many kinds of wanderers and travelers. This forest became a living home for the orange and black orioles and the scarlet cardinals and the blue, 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 blue jays that we called God's forest jewels. Here, too, there came butterflies landing with the tiniest thuds on the slender grasses, making the long blades sway back and forth just the littlest bit from their tiny weights. And also in the early morning, for just a very few minutes, if you rose early enough, you could see the dew outlining every shape in the forest for as far as you could see, like tiny strings of bright lights in the dark. The dew edged every thorn, every bristle, every serrated edge of every long grass, every point of every single leaf, and it clung to every rough edge of tree bark, to every stick, to every forgotten child's toy left in the woods overnight. In early light, the once empty field, now forest, shone like a palace, where every shape took light and returned it to us a thousandfold, and Uncle and I felt certain that we stood in God's great garden, Eden.
Thank you. in his octopus's garden in the shade. Storm in our little hideaway beneath the waves, resting our head on the seabed in an octopus's garden near a cave. We would sing and dance around because we know we can't be found. I'd like to be in the shade.
Go at half.
We would shout and swim about the coral that lies beneath the waves. Oh, what joy for every girl and boy, knowing they're happy and they're safe. We would be so happy, you and me, no one there to tell us what to do. I'd like to be under the sea in an octopus's garden with you. In an octopus's garden with you. In an octopus's garden with you.
The Christmas tree's on fire. It's burning down the house. Flames are getting higher and I'm trying to put it out. I'm beating it back with a tube sock and a cushion off the couch. The Christmas tree's on fire and it's burning down the house. Valentine's Day, my boyfriend's out of town, but he told me before he went last month, he said, make sure you take it down.
I am Velocity Child, and every Friday at the stroke of midnight, ride the broomstick with Fallen Woman. A weekly psychic fusion of forward thoughts, far out ideas, magical foray, and spellbinding song. Stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.